From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, since a video ridiculing the Prophet Muhammad appeared on YouTube, anti-American protests have erupted throughout the Middle East. The violence led to the death of the U.S. ambassador in Libya and three other Americans, the storming of the U.S. embassy in Yemen and clashes with riot police, as well as threats of violence to U.S. embassies throughout the world. What does this mean for the future of U.S.-Middle Eastern relations, and should the U.S. get further involved? How do we balance democracy with diplomacy? These are some of the questions we hope to focus on in the hour ahead. You can join us for Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Protests spread on Friday and over the weekend across the Middle East and into North Africa and beyond in the wake of an anti-Islamic video, ridiculing the Prophet Muhammad, titled Innocence of Muslims, which was posted late last week on YouTube and has been linked by some to the deaths in Benghazi of U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three of his colleagues. In this morning's opening Forum Hour, we want to turn our attention once more to ongoing developments in the Middle East and to help us understand what is going on and what may continue to go on. Peter Bartu is joining us in studio, visiting scholar at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at UC Berkeley. He's also retired senior mediation expert for the United Nations. Welcome.
Thanks very much, Michael.
Glad to have you here. Also glad to have Jane Wales here in studio with us, President and CEO of the World Affairs Council, former Senior Director of the National Security Council. Welcome, Jane Wales.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. We'll also say good morning to Shibli Tahami, who is Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at University of Maryland, and also a Senior Fellow at the Saban Center for Middle Eastern Policy at the Brookings Institution and former advisor to the U.S. State Department. Good to have you back, Shibli Tahami.
Always my pleasure.
And Mona Yacoubian is also joining us in this discussion. She is senior advisor on the Middle East with the Stimson Center, a nonprofit, nonpartisan institution for enhancing international peace and security. Welcome, Mona Yacoubian.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
Glad to have you. And I'm going to begin with Peter Bartu, who actually knew Chris Stevens. We were talking about the fact that Chris Stevens was from Piedmont and went to UC Berkeley and was a graduate of UC Hastings here in the Bay Area, well known to many and certainly a loss and someone whom many are grieving over. And you knew him quite well, Peter.
That's right, Michael. Ambassador Chris Stevens and I go back for almost a decade now. We worked alongside of each other, firstly in Jerusalem in 2002-2003. Chris at that time was the political director at the U.S. Consulate, and I was working on the Middle East peace process with the UN at the time. Chris was professional, personal, had a competent style. He was an excellent communicator, very sensitive to other cultures, could put himself in other people's shoes, and was able to grasp the nuance and the simplicities of a lot of very, very complicated situations. We were pleasantly surprised to find ourselves both in Benghazi together early on in the revolution last year in Libya. Again, I was working with the United Nations, and Chris was at the time the envoy to the National Transitional Council. He was, all of the platitudes are true, did a tremendous professional job there, and will be sorely missed, not just by the United States and the Department of State, but also by many Libyans who have been overwhelming in pouring out their grief and condolences.
There's been a lot of call for support from Libyans, particularly in the present government, and I'm wondering if, we can extrapolate as much as we want, I suppose, from Chris Stevens' life, but there are those who say, on the one hand, that he would want the United States to not only move forward with tightening and making continue good amicable relations with Libya as much as possible, but not to take this as an excuse to say, for example, with Syria, that we should not get involved, because look what happens when we get involved.
Well, I think that certainly is the wiser course, and certainly Chris Stevens, I think, would have approved of that. We're seeing probably the most profound transformation in the region that we've seen for many, many decades, and I think it's important for the U.S. to remain deeply engaged to the extent possible in every circumstance. But each country has got quite different issues, quite different context, and to the extent that one shares this with other partners, goes it alone, leads from in front or from behind, needs to be weighed up very carefully.
What is your take? I mean, as someone who's actually sat down and negotiated with terrorists and with some of those who are sowing all of this whirlwind of violence, was the the film an excuse, or were things perhaps more orchestrated?
Oh well, I think sadly that film has operated on many levels. Let me just start it from a very personal perspective. You know, written into the DNA of the United States and its form of democracy is this right to free speech. It's part of the identity of the country. Recognise that for a quarter of the world's population, which identifies itself as Muslim, that the Quran and the Prophet are equally a red line and out of bounds. On a personal level, people find it incomprehensible that
the United States should be blamed for some crackpot making a film, basically.
That the crackpot would make the film in the first place is what they'd find incomprehensible. They wouldn't quite understand that. You know, many understand the difference between the government, the United States, its representatives, and crackpot citizens. Unfortunately, the most visible symbols that we have often in these countries abroad are the representative offices, are the consulates, are the embassies, and they draw the ire. But back to your point, the other dimension, of course, is that there is always someone who's going to take advantage of these type of examples and inflame them, as it were. So it's going to be a very bumpy road, and as you know, has been made elsewhere with the internet and other forms of communication. We can be sure that it's going to happen again at some point. I mean, we had internationals killed in Afghanistan last year when Qurans were burned in Florida, and here we have another sad example of the same thing. It's not going away.
Again, Peter Bartus, visiting scholar at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at UC Berkeley and a retired senior mediation expert for the United Nations. Jane Wales is also in the studio with us, and she's president and CEO of the World Affairs Council and former senior director of National Security Council. Jane, I don't know if you saw a Sunday Chronicle article by Mustafa Malik. Essentially, he took the argument that we need to be, the United States and the West needs to be more sensitive and more responsive to just what Peter Bartu was talking about. And the vilification of Islam or the Prophet, has to somehow be curbed, that we have to, we have the sanctity idea of free speech in this country, and yet I think his argument was that we need to be more understanding of this being seen as an attack on Islam and do something to stop it.
I didn't see the article, but I think the way you've described it sounds absolutely right, that while we may not be in a position to curb that kind of what is being characterized as free speech, we would do well to better understand its effects. This is a situation in which you basically have the confluence of three realities. The first is that we're in a world without editors. And editors provide sort of a screen of good taste and common sense. We don't have that anymore. Anybody can post a film. Secondly, you've got very weak states in the region. And third, you've got kind of a globalization of culture and identity, a world in which perhaps the yearning for respect is the greatest unmet need. And that combination puts us in a very, it creates a tinderbox in essence.
But how do you read the effects of this tinderbox now? I mean, Pakistan just erupted over the weekend, and now Nasrallah of Hezbollah has been, causing even more eruptions in Lebanon. Is it going to dissipate, or is it just going to continue to inflame and spread like a conflagration?
I'm with Peter on this. I think such things as that film will always be in a position to provoke. The question is, can we somehow separate these kinds of expressions from the United States as an entity? Right now, they're merged in people's minds. And I think sort of nuance about what the First Amendment means and when it's crying fire in a crowded theater and when it's hate speech or not, that's nuance that is not necessarily captured by those who would demonstrate, protest, and even resort to violence.
But as Peter also said, each country is separate and probably needs to be dealt with in a separate or individualistic way, does it not?
That is true, and I agree with him on that point as well. But I do think that there is a sense of identity that's at stake right now, and a sense that everything I am is being disrespected, in essence, is being treated with scorn. and the sort of the sense of humiliation. And I just think, you know, arguments over what the First Amendment says is lost in that setting.
Well, Shibley Tahami, let me bring you into this. And again, Shibley Tahami is Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at University of Maryland and Senior Fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings, former advisor to the U.S. State Department. How do we separate, really, the effect of this film from, well, the Salafis and the jihadis and the anti-American militants? It's difficult not to conflate them, but it perhaps needs to be separated?
No question they need to be separated. And I think, you know, I take a slightly different approach from my colleagues. I mean, I agree that obviously in a better world, we wouldn't have such racists and people who are going to provoke this type of reaction. But I think the reaction is much more complicated than just about this film. I mean, the film obviously is demeaning, and it's understandable that there would be such a widespread anger. But what we've seen is the targeting of that anger toward the U.S. and the violent part of it are really not easily explained simply by the film itself. And I think that there's no question that the immediate, even if the evidence was there from the outset, the U.S. Wasn't behind it, I think the U.S. still would have been targeted, because I think there's been built-up anger and mistrust of the U.S. that America's hand is seen in almost everything sinister related to the region. It is really a product of a horrible, horrible decade of destruction and war, the Iraq War, the Afghan War, and two Israeli wars that were supported by the U.S., the Lebanon War and the Gaza War, and I think that they have been absolutely humiliating, and a sense that Islam was under assault, largely because of the way the policy was framed in the aftermath of our own tragedy of 9/11. So I think it is far more complicated in terms of why the resentment of America. Now, we need to separate between the anger that is widespread and those who exploit that anger for political action. And I think that's where the real subtlety comes in. You know, if you look at where it all started, it started in places that have actually witnessed recent revolutions in Libya, Egypt, Tunisia, and Yemen. Now it's spread everywhere else. Those are places where there's a lot of contention for power right now, public empowerment coupled with a lot of attempt to settle the battles internally. And it is not a surprise on an issue that garners such broad sympathy across society, religion, and the Prophet Muhammad, that you were going to have those extremists exploiting it. It makes a lot of sense, and in a way threatened the authorities. And two things come together to make it a little bit more complicated for governments to react, whether it's the Tunisian government, the Libyan government, or the Egyptian government. One is that there is no authority there is no government with moral authority yet. And part of it is a vacuum of leadership that we've seen. Remember, the Arab revolutions have been leaderless. I mean, this has been a primarily grassroots movements. This has been why they've been authentic. Part of what's attractive about them, part of the reasons why they fit the aspiration of the public. But the bottom line is they're leaderless, and we still don't have a Nelson Mandela type who can say, okay, I agree with you, we should be angry, but this is wrong, we can't behave that way. There is no one like that. And all the governments are very fearful of asserting the power of the state coercively, in part because that's what the dictators were doing, and even the security services are reluctant. So that makes it much more difficult for them to weigh in on this debate to stop the extremists from winning the day. And I think that this is why, in my own view, the U.S. simply cannot just detach itself. We have to understand that there are internal battles going on, and we have a stake in how they come out. And if we pull out or react in a particularly strong negative way, we're in essence giving in to those who are disrupting the agenda, not only for governments within, but also for American policy in the region.
But there's more to add to the cauldron that you've so well presented to us. I mean, there's not only the difficulty of establishing rule of law, which is pretty daunting, but all that economic instability. You've got more unemployed youth in many of these Arab countries, than anywhere in the world, just about. Harnessing somehow those young people, as opposed to getting them involved in demonstrations and attacking embassies to find work for them is perhaps one of the biggest challenges, the economic challenge.
I'm not really sure about that, to be honest with you. I think economics are very important. They're certainly a motivating factor in ultimately getting larger numbers into the streets in the uprisings. I don't really think it's in the core about economics, or even if you look at the people who initially took the risk with their lives and led the revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt and Yemen, they were not actually those jobless or the less educated or the people who are looking for food. It was far more complicated than that, and I think it still is. It's about politics and exploitation of economics.
Well, there's also a view throughout the Arab world and throughout maybe the Islamic world that somehow the West is at war with them, or, you know, this is the neo-crusades or something along those lines. In fact, I was reading an article by Ed Hussein, the Consul for Foreign Relations. He was saying, how do we puncture that? I mean, have some thoughts to shed on that? That notion that the United States is anti-Islam?
Well, let me give you an example which I think might put it in perspective. I think that broadly you're right. Obviously, there's some sense that the Muslim world is under assault from the West, and this actually goes back centuries, not just decades. But I think we really mislead if we think this is at the core. I think it is at the core, wrapped into a policy of just a couple of decades, and mostly focused on the U.S. And if you look, for example, at France, which it had a colonial history, was hated. In fact, the early 20th century were more hated than any European power. It stayed a colonial power through the part of the 1960s. And over the past several decades, the attitudes toward France changed dramatically. And in fact, in polls that I do in the Arab world, France is most favored as a superpower. People look at French democracy as a model.
Forgive me, is that before or after the most recent election of a socialist leader?
Well, no, perhaps not. But no, I'm talking about over the past decade. I'm talking about when Jacques Chirac was identified, just as we were talking about the clash of civilizations after 9/11, Jacques Chirac was identified in the Arab polls as the single most admired leader in the Arab world, in large part because he was seen to have stood up to George W. Bush on the Iraq issue and been sympathetic to the Palestinian question. And during that period, if you recall, the French were banning the veil in the French schools. There were confrontation with immigrants largely from Muslim countries. They were making headways in the Arab world. And the Islamists couldn't find themselves to criticize France because of its position on foreign policy. Sheikh Qaradawi, one of the most influential clerics in the Middle East on Al Jazeera, when he was asked about the French, assault on Islam, he said, well, why are you focused on the French? They're supporting us on Iraq. They're helping the Palestinians. So I think we mislead if we think it's all about religion. Religion is very important for all people in the Middle East. People tend to be religious. They certainly want to protect their values. But in the end, their judgments are not based largely on religion. There is something else going on here that is much bigger, and we have to understand that.
Well, let me bring Mona Yacoubian into this. She's senior advisor of Middle East for the Stimson Center. They're a nonprofit, nonpartisan institution for enhancing international peace and security. And wondering, when we talk about peace and security, Mona Yacoubian, are we seeing the Arab Spring sort of in a trajectory more toward becoming the despots are gone, and there's a hope that many of these countries will become more like Turkey? But are we going to see perhaps more radicalism and more of a struggle for radicalism to be more hegemonic?
Well, I think in the short term, we have to expect the sorts of dislocation that we're seeing. I mean, after all, what we're witnessing, I think, in the Middle East is really the lifting of decades of repression. This is, as Peter said at the beginning of an historic transformation. So to expect that the transitions would simply proceed smoothly without disruption, I think, is unrealistic. As for the trajectory of where these countries are going and how these transitions are going to result, I think that the jury is still very much out. My sense is that the region is very much in a precarious position at this point, and the trajectories could go in either direction. We could either see a deepening of democratic values, outreach to the global economy, greater peace and prosperity. Or, by contrast, we may see things go in the opposite direction. I think that's why it's so important for the United States to remain engaged, because we are at such a critical juncture in the history of the Middle East.
Now, there are some who are saying with more shale gas, we'll be less dependent on Arab oil, and there are also those who say we should be perhaps less involved, particularly with what happened in Libya. Do you think that it would be a good idea, for example, for the United States to have a no-fly zone over Syria at this point?
I think calls for a no-fly zone over Syria at this point are still premature. It's very painful and difficult to watch the suffering that's going on in Syria, but I also think that what we've witnessed in Libya underscores the complexity of the forces that are at play on the ground. It's not at all clear at this point that there's international support for a no-fly zone. There's certainly not consensus in the United Nations. And I think barring that kind of broad international support, it's very difficult to move forward, particularly given how uncertain we are about the forces at play on the ground in a place like Syria.
Professor Talhami was talking about polling, and I happen to come across a poll of Egyptian Muslims that tells us that 75% don't believe that Arabs were behind 9/11. That's according to Janice Bartlett in the New York Times. That's a pretty daunting kind of figure to grapple with, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I think what it points to is this deep mistrust that unfortunately characterizes relations between the Arab world and the West. I think I would differ slightly with Shibli. I think that the causes are both within the past decade, but also harken back further. I do think there is a legacy of mistrust that's connected to not only colonialism, but to America's position vis-a-vis the Arab-Israeli conflict. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding, unfortunately, that has characterized relations, and I think that that poll is just one example of that.
Mona Yacoubian, again, a senior advisor to the Middle East Stimson Center. We're coming up on a break here, but I want to afford you, our listeners, an opportunity to join this conversation. In fact, you're cordially invited to do that. Our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, and we do invite your calls. The toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free from anywhere, 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment, or post any questions or comments on our Facebook page. But we would like to hear from you. There's one other way to communicate with us, of course, and that's through Twitter. Our handle is @KQED Forum. We're talking about latest developments in the Middle East and talking really about what the United States' role ought to be, but also a lot of the nuances of an ongoing volatile situation, to put it mildly. With us in studio is Peter Bartu, visiting scholar at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at UC Berkeley, and Jane Wales, president and CEO of the World Affairs Council. We also have with us on the line Shibli Talhami, Anwar Sadat, professor for peace and development at University of Maryland, and Mona Yacoubian, who is senior advisor on the Middle East to the Stimson Center. When we return, we hear from you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Since a video ridiculing the Prophet Muhammad appeared on YouTube, anti-American protests have erupted throughout the Middle East and in North Africa and in Pakistan, and the violence led to the death of U.S. Ambassador to Libya, Chris Stevens, the storming of the U.S. Embassy in Yemen, clashes with riot police. We're asking, what does this mean for the future of the Middle East, and should the U.S. get further involved, and how do we balance democracy with diplomacy? Mona Yacoubian of the Stimson Center is with us by phone, and so is Shibli Talhami, former advisor to the U.S. State Department. With us in studio are Jane Wales, president and CEO of the World Affairs Council and former senior director of the National Security Council, and Peter Bartu, visiting scholar at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at UC Berkeley. And Peter Bartu, I'm going to go to some of our emails here before I go to our callers. Here's a listener named Craig who says, there's strong evidence that Chris Stevens' death was caused by an al-Qaeda attack set for 9/11 in revenge for the killing of their second-in-command a few weeks earlier by a U.S. drone strike, and that the protests against the film were simply taking advantage of. Please stop conflating these two groups. Well,
Firstly, let me just say that I don't think the evidence is conclusive in relation to that conclusion at all. There's been a number of reports coming out of Benghazi from different militia chiefs over the weekend that I've seen that point to a homegrown group being involved and taking advantage.
There are 50 arrests so far. These are not Al-Qaeda operatives,
actually,
as far as we know.
There's 50 under investigation and 4 arrests at present.
Do we know if these are Al-Qaeda linked?
Again, until there's a full investigation, I would not jump to any conclusions. But from my knowledge of the situation in Benghazi and eastern Libya, there's a real prospect that this is indeed a homegrown group and not an Al-Qaeda affiliate or an imported outfit, as it were.
Weren't many of the jihadis who were going to Iraq coming out of eastern Libya? I mean, there's a real concentration of them there, isn't there?
That's correct, coming particularly from the town of Derna in east Libya. Libya, in terms of jihadis and extremist groups, was in the export business, not the import business.
Question from a listener named Anne Jane Wells. To what extent did Obama's speech in Cairo raise false expectations?
Well, that's an interesting point. I'm not sure I'd relate the two, the events today and events over the past several days to Obama's speech in Cairo. But it certainly was an effort to try to change the relationship between the United States and the people of the region, not so much the states of the region, but it was outreach to the people. And surely whatever is done after that will, to some extent, disappoint. I mean, if you think that an entire set of assumptions will be erased by one speech, I think that's asking too much. I'm with Shibley. I think it's complicated.
Well, Shibley, let me go to you with another question from a listener named Joe, who says, it's a statement. I'll get your response to it. He says, it seems like a religion that puts a higher premium on one crackpot making an amateurish film than on human lives is worthy of examination and perhaps some criticism, just what free speech should be about. Islam, though, demands that everyone, Muslim or not criticize it. Certainly, we can't lose that in the West. I lived in Britain for 10 years, and it was discussed amongst the chattering classes that Islam was beyond examination and discussion, not out of respect, but out of fear of being blown up. How do you think that we should maintain our principle of free speech? The argument that the antidote for unpopular speech is more speech may not work, but what would work? We can't capitulate.
First of all, I agree about the importance of free speech. I'm one of the big defenders of it, and I think that censorship is not the way to go. I think it's far more complicated than that. I agree with that. But I think it's interesting that the question also tried to implicate, quote, the religion for the acts of few crackpots who are attacking the embassies. These are not the overwhelming majorities who are angry. I mean, I think the fact that you have a lot of people who are angry doesn't mean they're all acting in a crazy manner to kill innocent people, as happened with the case of Ambassador Stevens, whom I also had the honor of knowing and sharing a Berkeley experience together. I think that when you look at the reaction in the Arab world, I mean, I am troubled, and I have to say this, not just about the reaction in the Arab world, but the reaction that we're having here, which is that if you look at what transpired over the past week or so, we had the disruption of domestic priorities, separate from the tragedy which we all have witnessed. You have a disruption of domestic priorities, a disruption of regional priorities, disruption of the relationship between the United States and the Middle East, disruptions of global priorities in some ways, all happening because of one, possibly one person, maybe a few more, regardless, with limited resources, acting independently in a manner that no one can really prevent. And so the fact that if people can allow themselves to be manipulated by somebody who's provocative is troubling. And we are being manipulated, I think, here, because we're in some ways also overreacting. Not overreacting because our interests are attacked. You have to react. I mean, something happened. We lost people. It's unacceptable that our missions be attacked. But we can't from that leap into this conclusion about it's all forget it. They're all like this. Or forget it, we can't do anything. Or forget it, it's about that religion that we can't understand. We're going back into the same mode. I think don't panic. This is a time for sober, differentiated analysis. it may turn out to be that it was a terrorist group or Al-Qaeda who actually attacked the Libyan mission. We don't know that for sure. But regardless, even if it weren't, you're going to have extremists within each polity that is now battling its internal battle, try to exploit the emotions that come wrapped around this issue. And even before we can deal with the long-term problem of mistrust of America that is far bigger than we can deal with in the short term, we need to have some careful diplomacy to try to repair the damage, understand the internal conflicts, differentiate between understandable anger and unacceptable action, and behave in that space.
Given the sensible remarks we've just heard from Professor Tahami Monayakubi, let me go to you with another question from a listener who says, trying to understand the mentality of a person on the Arab street, two related observations come to my mind. If you don't enjoy freedom of speech, it's hard for you to comprehend its full implications. Similarly, if your government is behind all media, it's hard for you to accept that others aren't.
Well, I think actually that's a very astute observation, because I think there's certainly a misconception in the Arab world. They don't understand why it is that the maker of this film is not able to be arrested and prosecuted. They really don't have a full appreciation of America's freedom of speech and all that the liberties that that affords. And in fact, in that part of the world, more often than not, people are able to be arrested and so forth for all kinds of much more innocuous expressions of free speech. So I do think there's a significant gulf in understanding. But I also think it's important for Americans to understand that whereas we value those individual freedoms, there is also, I think, in the Middle East, a much deeper sense of community and a much deeper sense of the sanctity of their religion and ways in which these kinds of films and so forth assault that. I'm not trying to excuse it, but I think it's important to try and understand a little bit more the very different priorities or the ways in which values are expressed differently by one culture versus the other.
Well, there is a good deal of anger in the wake of these latest developments. I'm just going to read one website comment, then I'm going to go to your calls. This is from Beth, who says, what is ridiculing the Prophet Muhammad? Is it anything that isn't positive or amounts to encouraging non-belief in him? And just how many of these rioters have even seen the YouTube video? Seems to me that most are illiterate and are being encouraged to riot by others. Often those who, like Osama bin Laden, had others do the destruction and killing while they themselves stayed safely out of harm's way. And would someone please explain why our country gives billions of dollars to these countries who then encourage their people to hate and harm us? Why go out of your way to kiss a rattlesnake? Jane Wales, you look like you want to respond
to that.
Well,
I'm not sure that we have evidence that the leadership has encouraged this kind of behavior. Quite the contrary. Certainly,
particularly in Libya.
Both Libya, yeah, but yeah, also Egypt, where it all started. So I think that there's a disconnect there. We've got real interests in the region. And if nothing else, I mean, I think we should sort of step back and understand the degree to which, politics are in flux in these various countries, and their future is contested. You've got extremists on the one hand that seem, certainly in Libya, to represent a small minority. You've got others on the other hand that would like to move toward a real mature democracy. We've got an interest as to which choices embraced.
All right, and we also have an interest in getting our callers on here. And let's begin, Danny, with you. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. So I'm wondering, I hear some of the panelists excusing and saying they're not excusing, some of the sanctity that the Muslim world puts on its religion and so on. But I'm just wondering what's up with the sanctity of life. I mean, these guys go out and kill our diplomats, and we're here debating a stupid movie instead of focusing on where the focus should be on the violence, against us.
Let me echo what you said, by the way. I saw the movie, as many have, and it is a stupid movie. I mean, there's no other way to characterize it.
Exactly. When Tahami speaks of a few crackpots, a crackpot over here makes a real stupid 2-cent movie, and when he talks about the crackpots over there, they happen to be killing and murdering our citizens and our diplomats. So there's a slight difference, and this comparison of we made a movie, or someone, a crackpot here made a movie, a crackpot there goes and kills our people, that just is insane. I mean, why isn't the Arab world and Muslim anger or outrage put on what's going on in Syria, where, you know, 150 people are killed every day.
Well, you're raising a number of points, but I think perhaps the central point is the value of life as opposed to the value that's put on a film that desecrates or that demeans Islam. What would you say in response to this caller, Chibli Tahami?
Well, first of all, there's no question the sanctity of life is central. And as I said before, I mean, I think we need to differentiate between legitimate anger, which most people in Arab and Muslim countries feel, you know, an assault on them, and a humiliating film, and those who are actually carrying out those, you know, horrible attacks, or the killers who are killing innocent people. I mean, you know, you can't equate the two. I mean, there are two different sorts of things, and that's why I always say, you know, that we're conflating the two together. This is not really a helpful to just say they are out there. I mean, governments have tried to take a position against this. They've taken a position against this. Some religious scholars have taken a position against this. The Mufti in Saudi Arabia today issued a statement saying this is wrong, un-Islamic, with the attacks that are taking place. And I think a lot of people would probably agree with him. But as I said earlier, though, the problem is that we don't have, in this time of transition and empowerment, we don't have a particular leader with the moral authority to just and security to go out there and say, I'm going to stop this. In part because, remember what the uprisings have been about. They're about dictators not listening to the people, and dictators who are, when needed, shoot their people. The security forces who were shooting at the order of Mubarak or at the order of Ben Ali or at the order of anybody else, they're now in trouble. And so there's a reluctance to reassert, you know, the power of the state, the coercive power of the state, which they're going to have to do to bring about security and to make sense. So I think that vacuum is not helping, and it's spreading. And then when it spreads, what you have is people who want to focus on the Islamic symbol because it helps them, like Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah in Lebanon saying, you know, let's go for a week now to demonstrate. He said he didn't do it before because the Pope was visiting in Lebanon. He didn't want to, anyway, it seemed unseemly that he would do it then. But why is he doing it? Because obviously it focuses attention on his enemies. It focuses attention on this labeling of Muslims, Islam as a cause, and it helps a lot of people. So it's used internally in the conflict. That's the thing that we have to focus on.
And again, Chibli Tahami is with the Brookings Institution Senior Fellow at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy. And Neil, you're our next caller. Join us. Hi.
Morning. We've talked about the vilification of Islam, and I'm curious as to why, in the context of this conversation, it seems like it's so easy for us to believe that this is a group of Muslims retaliating over this movie and not the act of a specific political or terrorist entity like Al-Qaeda or whatever. I feel like the latter requires evidence, but the former just seems easier to believe. I mean, if I recall my Edward Said, it sounds like the vilification of Islam is implicit in these assumptions. And there are a billion Muslims in the world. Not all of them are all in the streets. And I feel like those that aren't either don't care or are, like the rest of us, mourning the loss of our ambassador.
Well, Peter Bartu, you said before we need evidence, and that is clear. And that's clear from the caller's point of view, too, I think, isn't it?
Oh, that's right. Look, Neil, I think, just again, from my knowledge of the situation in Benghazi, the circumstances around Ambassador Stevens' death echo a similar death last year with the assassination of Abdel Fattah Yunus, who was the Libyan Ministry of Interior under Gaddafi, who switched over to the rebel side, who was killed in circumstances which have still not been made public, but it appeared to have been the work of a homegrown terrorist group that was interested in killing the minister on the basis of what he'd done under Gaddafi. Again, there's... you know, Benghazi is a provincial town. Everybody knows everybody else. There's been a number of reports over the weekend of potential involvement of a homegrown extremist group. And there are a number of these who do not believe in the extraordinary political transition that Libya is experiencing at the moment.
They're probably, more secularists and more, shall we say, I'm thinking of how to characterize those who are anti-Salafi or against this radical Islam in Libya right now in terms of holding the helms than there are radical Islamists, as far as we know.
Well, with Libya, I think everyone would identify as Islamists, first and foremost.
I'm talking about the extremists, though, that has been conflated and that we've been concerned about conflating here. The head of Libya, Abushagar, called for the support of the United States, and so many of those who are presently in the position of power are on his side, I believe.
No, absolutely. Look, there's an overwhelming imperative for among Libyan leadership and among the Libyan people for several things. One is to continue the democratic transition through to the return of constitutional government. There's an overwhelming outpouring of grief about the loss of Ambassador Stevens and his unique contributions to Libya's transitions. And these far outweigh the, for simplicity's sake, let's call them the Salafist groups that do not believe that democracy and Islam are compatible.
Colin, join us. You're on the air on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning. This is not to excuse the murder of the ambassador, but it's surely not lost to the people in the Arab world that the U.S. had been the only country on the U.N. Security Council to veto a resolution criticizing Israel's settlement policy in the West Bank last year. Even France, Britain, and Germany had voted for that resolution. Isn't a lot of this caused by our unquestioning support for Israel? If we had distanced ourselves from the policies of Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians, would we be seen as much of an adversary in this region? And I'd also like to have the panelists comment on whether, if we do wind up giving a green light to an Israeli attack upon Iran, what happens to our standing in the region then?
Well, let me get a response. I'm sorry, I was going to go to Mona Yacoubian on this first, Professor Tommy, and then we'll go to you.
Yeah, I think it's a real oversimplification to say that this is all about U.S. support for Israel. I think, as Shibley has noted, and others as well, the roots of the anger that have propelled these protests are quite deep. And it does not just simply resonate that it's about U.S. support for Israel that's led people out into the streets. There's the history of U.S.'s involvement in Iraq. There's the issue of Abu Ghraib. There's many episodes that I think have inflamed Muslim populations. And so to simply reduce it to U.S. support for Israel, I think, really misses the nuance and the complexity of the situation on the ground. In terms of Iran and whether there's a conflict with Iran, my own sense is that would certainly inflame tensions further, and I think that's why you're seeing the Obama administration be far more reticent and try to sort of slow the pace toward any kind of military confrontation, precisely because it could unleash a much wider regional conflagration.
And Shibley Tahami.
Again, let's separate, you know, the causes of this particular episode from the pervasive anger and mistrust that Arabs have of the U.S. You know, the two are not directly related, they're only indirectly related. But the latter, I think we know what the roots of the anger are about. We've been polling on this for more than a decade, and more than any issue, the Arabs evaluate America and mistrust America and are suspicious of America over principally two issues. Number one, the Arab-Israeli issue, which I think remains the prism of pain through which Arabs evaluate America. We've seen that, you know, in the polls up and down depending on the position. And second, the presence of American troops in the Gulf broadly incorporating the Iraq War. I think there are the two clusters of issues that are most central in the minds of Arabs in evaluating American foreign policy. Of course, they can't be divorced from the history of the 20th century. I wouldn't go the decades into Western Islam. I think, of course, there's a little bit of that in the discourse, but the political consciousness of the Arabs, the contemporary political consciousness of the Arabs, is really a post-World War I consciousness, in which there was a confrontation between Arabs and the West. The West did conspire behind the backs of the Arabs after the war to put in place a system that was advantageous to the West, a system of control to the West. Arabs never fully recovered from that. All the political movements since have been tied to this pervasive anger with the West that Arabs have, but more recently, much more tied to American foreign policy and foreign policy issues specifically on the Arab-Israeli conflict and the Gulf region, American presence. Those are really the cornerstones of how people in the back of their minds make an assessment, and that's why they have anger, that's why they have suspicion. That doesn't explain those criminals who are killing. It doesn't explain that. It explains a mindset. And we have to understand that. Again, I go back to differentiating. The anger has different seeds from the actual carrying out of militant attacks.
And you are listening to Forum. We're talking with Shibli Talhami, with Moni Yacoubian, with Peter Bartu and Jane Wales. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED Radio, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Let me read a couple of your comments on our website. Chris writes, I spent the majority of my time over the last 8.5 years in the Middle East and Afghanistan. On balance, I would like to say that most of the Muslims I have lived and worked with are wonderfully gentle souls and quite devoted followers of the Muslim religion. Excuse me. It seems that there are folks everywhere looking for an excuse, like in the Rodney King beating. It was a terrible event, to be sure, but the extent of the riots was equally awful. Jonah commented online, why do reports focus on this film being made in America instead of it's being made by an Egyptian-born Christian who immigrated? Also, given that Nakula Baseli Nakula has been convicted of at least 2 felonies, that's one more than I thought from my reading, but anyway, in the United States, why hasn't his citizenship been revoked and why hasn't he been deported back to Egypt already? Well, let me bring some more of your calls in here, and let's go to Kate in Los Gatos. Kate, you're on.
Hi. My question is as follows. I have traveled extensively in the Middle East and in the Islamic part of Asia, Pakistan and India. And what always strikes me is that people, even intelligentsia, is unable to move on from rights, from wrongs that have been done to them in the past. For example, I'm of European descent. My parents have suffered tremendously during World War II. They were prisoners of war. They were in Poland, in camps. If my sons were to marry a German girl, the only thing my father would ask is, is she good for you? Do you love her? And in the Islamic world, that would be an impossible thing. Things from thousands of years ago are still so very much alive in the present. The partition in India is still very much alive in the present, for example. How come they can't move forward?
Kate, let me take your question. And Peter Bartu has done a lot of negotiating with both sides. What's your take on that, Peter, particularly in the sense of a historical consciousness that somehow can't be moved forward upon, as the caller says?
Well, look, I disagree with that, frankly. I think, again, what we're seeing right now across the Middle East in particular is an incredible transformation. If you look at the uprisings in Egypt, Libya and Tunisia, they weren't demonstrations against the United States. They were demonstrations against dictatorships and uprisings in support of legitimate, the case of legitimate government and electoral politics and return to constitutional government. It was an incredibly empowering experience. Each of these three countries is only a partway through its respective transitions. Tunisia has a constituent assembly that's delivered a draft constitution. Based on approval of that, it will have presidential or parliamentary elections, and then it'll, you know, go through the first phase of its transition. Egypt is muddling through in extraordinarily complicated circumstances. Libya, on the other hand, despite the tragedy of last week, has been able to elect a body and is going through a constitution-making process right now. People are asking real questions about the role of women in society, about the compatibility of Islam and democracy. This is not a conversation about the past, it's a conversation about the future. The tragedy for us at the moment is that we've been sidetracked from this very important conversation to talk about a ridiculous home movie and an extremist reaction to it. So they're looking forward and we need to walk with them in that.
Gene Wells, when we put all this in the perspective of the Arab Spring, what's happening even most recently in Pakistan and Lebanon, or scores continuing to be killed in Iraq, and the vice president there threatened to a death sentence, even Peter just mentioned Tunisia. Even in Tunisia, Salafists smashed up a bar that was serving alcohol, and in Syria we've got thousands and thousands who have been killed. one tries to get some optimism out of this, but it's difficult to think that the Arab Spring, I keep talking about that trajectory of the Arab Spring. It was liberating and it was moving toward democracy. And now in Libya, as Peter says, we've got a constitution, a parliament moving in the right direction. But we also have these terrible things that are just erupting everywhere and mushrooming.
I'm not sure whether how we would imagine a world in which the pace would have been faster, the pace of change would have been faster, to go from a populist uprising to a full constitutional government and a participatory democracy in a matter of months. This has been, in my view, fast-moving, given the sort of sweep of history.
Well, should we let it just move on its own accord in terms of, I mean, the real question hovering over this whole conversation is how much should the United States be involved and intervene? If there's a lot of enmity against the United States, which obviously there is throughout this whole region, including South Asia and Pakistan, maybe the United States, some would argue, perhaps not have such a big stick.
But I'd note that the place where we intervened and played the largest role, which is Libya, is in fact the place where there is the largest outpouring of concern for our point of view and worry and sadness and grief over this terrible murder. So I'd rather have Peter speak to this because he knows Libya well, but I'm not sure that our engagement politically or in that case even militarily proved to be a negative in their minds.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, alas, because we've come to the end of the hour. Thank you, Peter Bartu. Thank you, Jane Wales, and thank you, Shibley Tahami and Mona Yacoubian, and thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you, and we appreciate your being here with us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Another hour of Forum up ahead. Stay tuned for all of us here at KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.